Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are talking, we're actually going to do a little bit of culture. Martin, you look like a man who could do a little bit of culture in your life, a little enrichment.
I just can't believe you're saying that to me. I just can't. Seriously. You watch rugby, you know, seriously. Don't be telling me about culture.
Listen, the steroid bowl is the steroid bowl. Whatever's happening, it's all good. Put a ball on a pitch and I'll watch it. By the way, bit of housekeeping, guys. This week's Policed is out. I would recommend you go listening. We have a lot of podcasts. The Glow West last night, live podcast was a great success with Sarah Sproul. I would say also check that out. But if you want everything in one place, it's all in one place at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We get nothing, no ads, no sponsors, but we try to put a lot of work into bringing you people from across the globe. And it costs money, time, effort, and opportunity costs. It needs support. It needs your help. And it's a couple of quid to you, but it means the world to us. Anyway, we are thrilled to be joined on the line via Zoom by comedian, actor, writer, and all around really sound man, despite what you've heard, folks. Tyke Hickey. Tyke, thanks so much for taking time to talk to us.
Hello, gentlemen. It's a huge, huge pleasure and even an honour.
No, you're very kind to say so. But Tyke, just to go, do you want to give listeners an idea, first of all, people on social media, on Twitter, they probably will have been aware of your presence. But previous to that, previous to lockdown and COVID, what was your normal run-of-the-mill kind of way you created?
I've always had a few different, like, I'd kind of have a billionaire mentality, which is like, you know, have different sources of income. You know, that's what I learned on my Bob Proctor kind of courses. There's a live aspect to what I do, and then I suppose I do a lot of sketches online, and sometimes they don't directly work out as making money, but as I think I was saying to you on the phone, you know, sometimes you can do a sketch, it doesn't really land at all, and then somebody gives you a bell and says, do you want to do a voiceover because your voice sounded weird in that sketch and we liked it. So I found I was picking up a lot of work that type of way. But yeah, look, just like everybody else, COVID comes in. I was planning a national tour. I have this kind of Irish Republican character called Mairead Corkery, who's a woman who I play. And she had her own show in the Opera House, and there was loads of stuff happening. And then the play kind of kicked in or whatever. And I had a couple of weeks of, oh my God, what am I going to do? It's all about me. Why did COVID come and wreck my career? And then you just gain a bit of perspective when you look at what's happening around the world, I suppose. And I ended up doing I'm not trying to make myself out to be here or whatever, but I did a little fundraiser at the start where I put on a Rangers jersey. I'm a big Celtic fan. I put on a Rangers jersey and sang God Save the Queen in my garden and earned a few quid for a pay at a house. I actually sang the Sex Pistols version of God Save the Queen, which was the kind of crazy twist. Because I had a lot of Republicans, like it was gas. I was doing radio shows in Cork, and there was one of the producers in Cork was saying, fair play to you, you've managed to piss both sides off at the same time. Because there was English nationalists kind of ringing in going, how dare he take our great anthem in vain? But there was also Republicans going, we died because of that anthem, man. How dare you? You know, and I was like, this is... And I think I actually started getting attracted to pissing everyone off in that period and kind of just took from there, really, you know? So, yeah.
Has it been difficult now with the COVID being stuck in Cork?
That is a loaded question. What a
that for me now is barbed. That's barbed. No, man, I love Cork, to be honest. And like, I've just noticed that Dublin has slipped out of the top 10 in the most livable cities in Europe. So
it has actually, well spotted.
You know, so no, yeah, look, it's tough being locked up in a house. I would say that. Like at times, you know, like my flatmate tested positive recently enough, and we were all cooped up in the house. I luckily haven't got it yet. I had a test and I'm negative and stuff, but I think it's getting closer and closer to your door, right? And I love meeting people. Like, I like working away myself, but like the type of world that we work in, like, it's all about collaboration. Like, ideally, you know, I would love to meet you.
Same for us. I mean, yeah. Zoom is fine, but it's not the same as sitting down with people, or, you know, it's there's a different vibe off it altogether. But I know I was slagging a bit saying stuck in Cork, but I mean, your business depends on being able to move around.
Yeah, it does. But then I suppose when this thing kicked in as well, I was like, okay, what can I do to drive on in spite of the fact that everything is collapsing around us, as you know, because, you know, without getting too political too quickly, like, the arts have always been kicked to the side anyway by successive governments. And I think it's a societal thing as well. There's a perspective on the arts. I don't think we feel drastically different. It's not like the COVID kicked in and we're like, oh my God, nobody's looking after on the outside. Like, you always feel like you're kind of, I don't know. I mean, I just feel like it's a, I mean, like, I'd already had stuff with, I ran a production company called Cahoots, and we had like, at one stage we had a TV show at RT. We had like a 3-episode TV show, and I did an interview with them in around that period for one of their magazines. And one of the last questions that they asked me in the interview was, what's your day job? And I thought that just summed up the perspective on the arts in this country. Because I was like, now don't get me wrong, there's lots of comics that have day jobs and they do a bit of comedy on the side, and fair play to them. Like, there's lads called the Fuppin' Egypts who are sound. I've got great contact with them online and stuff. And I think they're possibly like psychiatric nurses by day and stuff. They make comedy on the side. But RT are very attracted, I think, to that model of like, look at this guy, he's got a job, like he's a farmer by day, whatever, but he's making little skits at night kind of thing. But some of us are actually, comedy is our profession, guys. Hello. You know, we imagine that, to think that you're going to actually have a career out of the arts. And that's, that problem is across Irish society, I think, generally. It's weird, like, this, you know, the saints and scholars and a country famed for its arts and artists. And yet, like, we always treat artists like they're doing a little bit of a kind of a thing on the side. Like, God love us, when are they going to snap out of it?
That's a lovely hobby you have there, Ty.
Exactly, yeah.
And actually, that I hate to break it to you, but I've heard several people make those comments about people, especially people who have found their income absolutely decimated by the lockdown, and they've said, oh well, look, that was a lovely little hobby they did, you know. And it's like, well
hobby,
no,
like,
yeah, yeah. I suppose, and we did speak about this before we recorded the podcast, but you mentioned, let's not get political right away, but I have to feel that we have to mention it, because when things are good, politicians want to be seen beside people from the arts, and it's been referred to us several times on this podcast over the last year, where they want your cultural capital, and there's a false sense of that we're in this together. But when things get bad, they're still taking home 90,000 euro a year, and your income is decimated. And they know, and now they're going, well, let's see about a small fund for the arts. It must be, you know, this isn't your first rodeo. You've seen this go up and down as it does, and no real solutions. I mean, there's no real solutions from them.
No, and the application form process as well. I mean, like, I just want to touch on that briefly, because it's like, most people I know are like, there's so little money and then everyone is competing with each other in this kind of hunger games to get the money, right? And then you blow about, it becomes a kind of a who can do the best application form process, because Ireland is a kind of an admin fueled kind of country. Like, we're just obsessed with kind of forms. It seems to be forms are the primary thing. You're competing against other artists, and you could blow a month of your time to gain a small amount of money that you're going to have to use to pay your bills. So if you have the audacity to say, I'm an artist and that's what I do, you need to fill out these forms to get money to actually live, because there's so little money coming in. Your art becomes secondary then, because you don't have time to do it, because you've just blown a month in filling out the form. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's and so the thing perpetuates. I mean, I know, for instance, in theatre in the continent, I think particularly in Germany, and there's structures to support artists, whether they're in plays or not. There's stuff constantly going on, and there's financial supports all the time, because they respect that, like, the arts is it's really important to the soul and the spirit of the country. You would imagine that a country that's famed for all their writers and artists and stuff would have the same attitude. But, like, really, I suppose, you know, a lot of those artists made it in spite of Ireland, really. Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, Joyce is probably our most famous literary son. And the first thing he did when he had at his earliest opportunity, he got the hell out of Ireland, like, because he realized how regressive it was. And I don't know, have we changed that much since then? And another quick thing on the application form thing, I'm not sure if many people are aware of this, because once or twice comics bring it up online. And I feel very passionate about comedy, like, obviously, but there's no comedy box to tick on application forms. Do you know what I mean? Like, now, if you want to pretend that your comedy is also a kind of a poem or something, or your comedy is like a kind of a documentary or whatever, if you can try and get it in under some sort of category that is ostensibly artistic, they might entertain it. But there's no comedy box, so comedy's not an art form. News to me, like, I didn't know, because most of my most interesting artistic experiences have been at comedy gigs. Do you know what I mean? Stuart Lee is a comic, but he's also got one of the most fiercely intelligent minds and creative minds that anyone's ever heard. You know what I mean?
The best comics tend to be quite geniuses in their own way. And like, whether it's political, philosophical or societal, they literally have this way of educating, informing and entertaining and making us laugh. But just, you mentioned the whole thing about not having that kind of respect for the genre as well, which must be infuriating. But I've seen it myself where you know, we have on Monday evenings the guys from the International Bar are doing their improv online now, and you know, we have, you know, all of these things where people are just struggling to make a few bob, and it's not even struggling to make a few bob, it's struggling to make art and not being given the space to do it, as you said, because the wolf is at the door. And it must be absolutely infuriating when you think about it in terms of, you know, I saw, and I think Martin, we made this point, that what Ireland put aside during the pandemic per head of population relative to what the UK did, and I'm not saying the UK is some sort of utopia, far from it, but it was 800% greater what they put towards the arts than what we did. 800% per head of population, phenomenally underrepresented, you know. And I saw Catherine Martin talking about things she wants to do, and it's all great things you want to do. You know, we need things actually done. If we could broaden it out, though, like, you've spoken brilliantly. I will refer to people, say, listen, go back, do listen to Tighe's interview with the lads, the two Norries. It's up on YouTube. I put the link up yesterday, I think, on Twitter. The guys are doing great stuff down there. You talked about part of your work as giving back as well. And part of that was part of your process. So I hope you don't mind me saying it, but you were talking about it as part of your recovery with your own issues with addiction, that this was it. Can we talk about that for a couple of minutes?
Of course. Yeah. So again, I suppose like the two Norries are doing, I think like what they're doing actually, not to put too fine a point on it, is kind of the future of recovery in a way, because recovery is a kind of a thing that needs to evolve, and like, we need to, I suppose, take advantage of new resources that we have and stuff. So their podcast is like, I think it's going to help people, it's going to help reach people at the moment anyway, where we can actually reach people through traditional forms in recovery. But again, like, it's interesting just to touch back on the arts thing. Like, the arts keep going in Ireland because artists gather around each other. Like, they don't wait for government to do anything because they kind of know the government isn't really going to step in. So again, with mental health stuff and recovery stuff, it's people helping each other. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm actually not even complaining about that, because that's where, like, nobody would understand an alcoholic like another alcoholic. Nobody understands a drug addict like a drug addict, somebody with an eating disorder, et cetera, et cetera. So in terms of giving back, I mean, look, I'm just a comic, like, from Cork, you know what I mean? So I don't really know what I'm talking about a lot of the time, but I just share my experiences. I suppose I made a decision, all right, on whether to go public or not, because sometimes when you're in recovery programs, you've got this decision to make where you kind of say, well, you know, this whole kind of scene is kind of anonymous. But because I'd started to become more and more well known, certainly in Cork anyway, or certainly in around my neighborhood in Cork, like, everyone knows me on my street in Cork, like, that I was like, look, I've got an opportunity here to kind of maybe try and reach people. So I started sharing my own story. I did an interview, I think, originally with Mario Rosenstock, who was really sound, actually, in Today FM. Really, really great guy. And so from there, I've just kind of let it be known that I'm available if somebody wants to kind of get onto me and be pointed in the right direction, basically. But the two Norries interview was kind of a big moment in that, I suppose, where when I did the interview with them, some of their previous stuff had been on drugs particularly, and I just put the focus on alcohol a little bit, because I think young people are getting into trouble with alcohol at times, and they don't even realize it when drugs is in the picture, but alcohol is such a, it's real massive problem in and of itself. And again, a bizarre thing about Ireland, without pontificating further here, guys, I feel like I'm pontificating again, but like, no. For a country that's absolutely like imbued in alcohol, we've kind of no it understanding goes. Of alcoholism at all. It's mad. It's just mad to me. Like, so again, very quickly, when I was doing a couple of interviews last year, when I was doing my solo show, I did a couple of TV and radio interviews where, again, the questions would be like, when did you stop drinking and then kind of turn your life around? But of course, like, when you stop drinking, you're worse, like way worse, because the anesthetic that I'd been using my whole life was taken away from me. So I was just frantically anxiety ridden and depressed for a few months. You know what I mean? So even though the WHO recognizes alcoholism as a mental health issue in this country, really, it's still a bit like, oh, when is he going to just stop drinking cans and fucking come to work? Do you know, like, where it's like, that was only the beginnings of my problem. So yeah. So if I could throw any of that stuff out in any interviews I get, and if somebody wants to talk about it, I never say no to it. And my, you know, my direct messages are always open if people want to be pointed in the right direction. But I'm not saying I'm going to heal anyone or cure anybody, because I'm just an idiot from Cork cracking gags on the internet. But I might be able to point them in the right direction.
You said anesthetic, and I think that's a good word. I think it's a good word to describe addiction. Was there a background to anesthetizing yourself with alcohol? I mean, a lot of people do it. We live weekend culture, or we did before COVID anyway, where people work their arses off all week and then drink all weekend. It's kind of an anesthetic to that crappy week. Is there part of that in it as well?
Totally, definitely. Like, it's, and I often wonder what role society plays and what role the person plays to get into the situation where the actual substance has taken over completely. It's a really interesting one, because, like, I'm a total lefty. If there's any opportunity to have a go off the government, I'll take it, obviously. But there's also an awful lot of personal responsibility for it as well. And this is part of the thing that I try to get across, that, you know, sometimes, I think we were talking on the phone about it as well, Tony, like, there's people where you kind of feel that they're part of this kind of leftist movement, but actually their grievance is their own, that they've had maybe personal trauma, that they have a vendetta against the government. I'm not so interested in that, really. I'm more interested in, like, okay, what can we change together here? Like, what's the collectivist kind of thing? But on the topic of alcoholism, yeah, I feel like the country doesn't really understand it, bizarrely, and successive governments don't invest in it enough. But I became an alcoholic because I became an alcoholic. And whatever reasons, you know, I can blame other people, I just found myself on a practical level that as long as I was blaming family, the government, the weather, I was in a hard luck story that I wasn't going to get well. And it was only when I started to take responsibility myself that I actually, for as much as I could do and try to make amends to people that I worried into the ground for years, that my life kind of turned around, you know. So I do think personal responsibility is really important. Like, I think I wouldn't be a big Jordan Peterson fan for a variety of reasons, but I think his message of accountability is decent.
Do you find yourself working it into your routines? Do you find it working it into your material? Is it a source of material for you?
100%. So this is another thing as well, why I did the show last year, In One Eye Out the Other, which was loosely about my drinking. I'd seen so many drinking stories on TV and film and stuff, and they're always so depressing. And I was just like, okay, my drinking was really depressing, but it was also hysterical. Like, it was, you know, it was like...
I think that's such a good point.
No, you know the saying, not all use is abuse. And there's, you know, like, if it wasn't fun, we wouldn't do it at some point, you know?
Absolutely, like, absolutely. And even when it was miserable, it was fun, if you know what I mean. Like, I was doing, like, live television on a kid's show in RTE, like, coming down off a cocktail of substances. And at the time, it was nerve-wracking, because, like, I was just in the door, and I'd walk in the door, like, 7 o'clock in the morning, and the director, who was an English guy, would hand me a pair of leather pants and the top, and he's like, oh, you're a rock star today in this tiny little bit, you're on live in, like, you know, an hour or whatever, and I'm seeing 3 or 4 of him, like, do you know what I mean? And, like, my head is gone, like, gone into a different planet, and horrific at the time, but, like, about a few days later, I'm laughing my head off at it, you know what I mean? So it's not and this is a great thing about the two Norris as well. There's no pontificating, and there's no kind of sanitized what we should be saying kind of thing with them. They're kind of saying, obviously, drugs are brilliant at the start, because otherwise, why are loads of people getting addicted to them? I think James often talks about the fact that he was suicidal before he started taking drugs. And then they kind of assuaged the issues for a while. And then he became like an awful lot worse. But that was my experience as well. Like without alcohol, I don't know where I would have been for a lot of years. But it was, yeah, so it was hilarious. It was ridiculous. It was surreal. And if you even park drugs, there's a real strong surreal element to drinking. Like I found myself, even though I was ostensibly like a sociable person, it was also a real loneliness to drinking. So in one or the other, there's this guy who's basically at home. He drinks cans. He's got kind of fantasies of having company. He creates a Home Alone like parade of characters going around a train set to kind of almost simulate company in the house. There's Sonia O'Sullivan is a cardboard cutout on it. There's a doll of E.T. who he takes out of the attic. But all these things were based on tiny little flashes of surreal consciousness in my mind. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And no drugs involved, like, because alcohol will twist your mind enough all by itself. No problem, as you probably know. Like,
are you finding the COVID a source of material, or is it just too hot to touch yet?
Interesting. I find, you know, I'm kind of going to have a little bash off RTE again here now, but, you know, I saw them do a collection of lockdown stories or COVID stories or whatever. And I'm just like, this is the last thing we want to watch now. Like, you know what I mean? Like, or COVID gags, or even though I actually did one the other day and it did really well for me. So I was kind of thinking of doing another one. But I tend to stay away from the sketches I'm writing at the moment. They tend to be set in a world where COVID isn't a thing. Because I find myself, do you know what I mean?
That's kind of what I'm getting at. Is like it's the same for everybody in the arts. If you're writing something, are you writing COVID into it? Are you writing about a world that doesn't have COVID? You know, it's a difficult one for everybody.
Yeah, like I've kind of longer form targets. So I'm writing a film with a friend of mine, Dominic, at the moment, and I've got some money from the Arts Council. I didn't have to fill out the application form, which is great. Somebody else took the lead on it, and he obviously didn't take comedy. But so we got some money to write a play. But those two things in my mind are totally set in a post-COVID world. I mean, you've got to, I think if you set yourself in this world right now, I think it would be very depressing artistically even to do that, you know?
It's, I do want to, so first of all, we've spoken on the phone, we've had a good conversation. People can see your sketch online. You do think about things both philosophically and politically. What founded that? That's years of that's not just that you woke up and said, actually, you know what, I'm one of these. Where did that all come from?
The kind of philosophy thing, is it?
Yeah.
Well, I have it back. Like, philosophy, I was first attracted to philosophy as a means of just kind of being able to say something smart in interviews like this down the line. I thought that'd be great.
Same as me. I read the cliff notes of a lot of stuff. That was mine.
I was actually studying sociology in first year arts in Cork, and there was this girl that I fancied doing philosophy. So I changed after a week. That's the honest story. But then about two or three days into the course, I forgotten about the girl, and my head was just gone and Socrates like. So, yeah, I just love stuff that I don't really fully understand, if that makes sense. And just little, I feel like the amount of knowledge I have, again, I suppose it's the Socrates idea of, like, you know thyself. And the only thing that he was really affirmative about in terms of his own knowledge was that he knew nothing. And I think that's really important in kind of today's world, I think, like, you know.
Well, I think philosophy comes easy if you're from Cork too.
Yeah, well, there's a philosophical bent to us, all right? Like, by the way, Martin, are you understanding me at the moment? Because I'm conscious that you're losing me.
I reading the lips, listening to the words.
Martin, do some sensational hand gestures as well if you want.
Martin thinks philosophy is the thing you get in the occasional what's a Christmas cracker or whatever it was. You know, it's like
I'm always on the lookout for it, I should say. Like in your Thomas Pringle, you know, towards the end, which was a brilliant episode, by the way, when you were talking about Fianna Fáil potentially abstaining and that being a choice as well. Like that's pure Jean-Paul Sartre.
Yes,
like,
I know. Yeah.
You know, by the not choosing is also a choice. And without getting too pretentious about it, like I did it at undergrad, I loved it. And then I went off and did other things, I suppose. But actually, during lockdown, I found myself more and more going back into those old ideas. And again, I'm a Cliff Note guy as well. I'm a YouTube video as opposed. like I've ended up living by a couple of Heideggerian ideas, but I certainly haven't gone back and read Heidegger, because that would be a huge waste of, I think, both our time.
No, you're a man after my own heart. It's like, give me the what? Oh, that's 27 minutes. I can do that.
And
God knows how many bad tweets I'll get out of it as well.
But Tony does it. We call it pocket philosophy when Tony does it.
No, I actually have and again, I think it's I stole the, I think Conor O'Burst wrote it, by the cornflake box philosophy.
Nice.
If it's short enough to fit in the back of a cornflake box, that'll do me. You know,
exactly. Yeah, but even just the distilled ideas, like there's one or two. Like Heidegger talks about the authentic life, and that's a reason why I ended up, you know, to bring it all back to the stuff we've been talking about. Like for years, I was making comedy. Like most of the stuff I did with RT was kind of sanitized. I still thought it was reasonably clever and stuff, but it was sanitized stuff. Like, because you need to get, you know, material across the line with a broadcaster, obviously. But then somewhere in the middle of it, I just thought, well, look, I have these kind of political views, and I have a decent platform, particularly on Twitter and stuff. And I also think that the state of the government is kind of funny and stuff. So it all just kind of came together that I ended up kind of making slightly more political. Because I think, like, you know, without blowing smoke up your bums, you're doing fantastic stuff. And I feel like, you know, for a while when I saw like the likes of Owen O'Brien doing what he's doing, I thought to myself, you know, I had a crisis there where I was like, that's what you should be doing, man. You should be going away. You should read a load more books, write a book on housing, and that'll be your contribution. And then you could think to yourself, no, I think he's probably okay. He's probably got it covered. Maybe I could just make jokes instead. And I think we all do our own little bit in our own little way. So I feel now I'm playing some small little part in the kind of the lefty comedy scene on the internet. And I'm at this moment in time, I'm totally happy with that. And I won't be publishing any books on housing in the next 12 to 18 months.
See, I've felt the same. I felt, why didn't I think of the Reddit thing? Why didn't I think of taking down the hedge fund? But we each do our own little piece.
Absolutely.
You know, and everybody's an expert in their own field, but they're a bullock when they're in somebody else's field, you know, and that's
nice.
But that is the way it is. And we get that a lot. And you talk about politics, about being a bit lefty. Like, we get that a lot in politics. You'll have a backbencher from arsehole of nowhere who's on, and he's not the health minister, and he's talking about health, and you're going, what the fuck are you doing?
you know.
And they're kind of journeymen in that sense. You could put them on and they'll spout nonsense about any subject, but you know, real people lack that confidence.
No. if they're not backbenchers, they get a podcast.
But you know, there's a confidence thing in that. How do you find that your confidence is with comedy? Has it built up your confidence a lot?
Wow, that's an interesting one. Yeah. Again, I'd almost go back to the authenticity thing as well. Like, I feel if you're not going to be yourself in comedy, and these are just kind of grades, like, you know what I mean? It's not like you're being totally fake, but if you're making something to try and get across the line with RT, for instance, in my experience, you can't really fully be yourself. Like, we did a sitcom where I was wearing a wig in the sitcom. I didn't want to wear the wig. I was told that it was a good idea to wear the wig. And then if I say, no, I'm not wearing a wig, they'd say, okay, well, go away then, because you don't have any leverage. You're not a big deal, and we'll just get someone else. So when you start doing more authentic stuff, like at the moment now, I just sit at home. I dream up an idea for a sketch. I whip out my camera. I do it, and I put it up on the internet. I get some abuse, occasional abuse, from people who describe themselves as bomb throwers, centrists, and disruptors, and they might have a Leinster flag in their
classic liberal.
And like, I love it, because I just have the type of character where I'm like, you know, if somebody's giving me crap and I can attempt to kind of give them some crap back, like, and have a little spat, I love it. I don't take it too personally, and I enjoy it. And if I can try and sometimes people are rational as well, like, occasionally, like, I find this about Twitter as well. It gets an awful bad rap, but like, I recently posted something, and there was somebody working in the philosophy department in UCC, excuse me, disagreed with me. And we had this like really pleasant kind of disagreement. And then I think I took a little bit from her and she took a bit from me. And I was like, this this is wonderful. Like, Twitter is a utopia.
I find it wonderful in that sense that you can talk to, I mean, that 6 degrees of separation is gone. You can talk to literally anybody at any time. And I agree with you, it gets a bad rap, but in general, it's a real source of material. It's a source of thinking. And I like to call it the crucible of ideas. I think it is the crucible of ideas.
Absolutely.
Just on the ideas of the sketches and that, and this is a broader question. It must be strange to look around the world now of social media, that bubble, and see these household names in many regards now that are, you know, like I remember the phenomenon where Jimmy Kimmel used to say they stopped looking at the ratings of his show and looked at the YouTube hits for the 4 minute segments that they put up. And that's when he was cute enough. He was well ahead. He said, don't talk ratings to me. Talk about the YouTube, you know, that 4 minute skit we did with Matt Damon. Oh my God, that's got 13 million hits or something. This has happened more and more now with social media. The likes of yourself, obviously, we keep going back to the fact that I think sometimes people forget that Big Dirty Fry invented the internet. you know, but like people, you know, It was there. The platform was there. We just didn't know that the need was there for it, but the need absolutely is there for it. Mm-hmm. What do you think in terms of that as a genre? How do you actually make that into something that isn't looked upon as, oh, that's a nice hobby he does?
Yeah, it's a tough one. Again, like Classic Ireland, we were way behind. You know what I mean? Like our idea of online comedy, like it's just so far after the event. It had already become a big thing in the States and stuff. But again, I suppose it's democratic, you know? Like if something does well, if there's an audience for it, stuff really takes off online that I mightn't think is particularly strong, or it's you know, it doesn't fit in with my cornflakes box philosophy. Yeah. Kind of, it, you know, it isn't underpinned by the degree of cornflakes philosophy intelligence that I'd like. But again, the following is there for it, and it really takes off. Then you take someone like Michael Fry, who's like, his stuff is kind of wildly original and really, really smart, and then takes off as well. And obviously I kind of love to see that then, because that gives us all kind of hope. But again, but on his one, actually, like you can really see even from the early stuff that he's being him. Like he's got an idea, like the news talk idea has, I can almost imagine it coming to mind and him thinking, yeah, would there be a following for that or not? Is not a big thing with him. He just thinks it's funny. He knows he can perform it really well and he puts it up there. And I think that's really exciting. And I even find with my own stuff, like, whether it was online or whether it was like plays or whatever, again, I'm harping back to this idea again of authenticity, but I did this kind of surreal show about my alcoholism that on paper you're kind of thinking, you know, why would you do this? Like it was really offbeat, gags per minute. It would have been like the Republic of Telly team would have thrown it out the window, like, because there wasn't enough gags per minute in it or per beat in it. And yet that was the thing that kind of nearly took off the most for me, and like ended up having this. I know obviously the COVID kicked in, but I was heading out on a national tour where I was going to Edinburgh. There was lots of interest from UK venues, and I was even kind of looking to maybe try and turn it into a TV series and stuff. But on paper, that would have been the project that people would have been like, oh, don't do that. Do this other thing that'll go down well with the demographics that RT have kind of shown you. Do you know? So like in a kind of a cheesy way, I would say like, be yourself. And that's what's great about the internet or whatever, that like you can literally, you could have a following, you know, you guys, you know, as much as I, or more than I do, you could have like a smallish following, but you produce something that kind of takes, you know, that's really strong and it just takes off, and your audience is incalculable, you know. It's, and I love that about it, the potential to get your comedy out there, but also for you guys to get your message out there and to platform really interesting people. You don't have to be a big wig, and you don't have to be a big corporation. You don't have to have big advertising behind you, like, you know. So yeah.
Do you find with the lockdowns and being in lockdown, do you find that you're doing a little introspection? And are you looking forward to the future? Have you big plans for the future?
Yeah, I've definitely done a lot of introspection. All right, oh my God. Like, I feel like in the first lockdown particularly, it was like, well, what's really important? And again, I know it sounds cheesy and pretentious, but the philosophy just kicks in again. Then we were like, okay, what has really made sense to me over the years? There's this guy, Anthony DeMello. He's kind of you probably know him, like this kind of spiritual teacher as well. And I ended up reading a lot of his stuff at the start of it. And it was about not like his main message is not taking yourself too seriously in a way. And that definitely kicked in because, you know, at the start, or just that it's not all about me, because at the very start, I know I'm kind of repeating myself now, but at the very start, when this thing kicked in, it was like, okay, my tour is being taken away from me. This was my year. I had a book coming out. I had a show. Why have you done this to me? But then, like, when you kind of snap out of that and just kind of think about what's going on generally for people, it just definitely kind of diffuses it and stuff, you know? And thinking about the future, yeah, I'm an optimist. Like, I'm just a cheeky, chappy, plucky lad from Cork. I'm always looking on the bright side of things, and there's going to be a way out of this. And my attitude to it is like, okay, the government is a nightmare. There's a lot of things broken with Irish society, but like, what can I do? And what I can do in the meantime is keep on plucking away, keep on making stuff, get the longer form stuff written so that when the world returns, I'm ready, I'm there, I've my hand up, I'll put my stuff out, and hopefully the stuff that I will be putting out will be, you know, there'll be a healthy dollop of leftist kind of anti Fine Gael nonsense, like, for people to enjoy.
You've just encapsulated all that really well the last sort of 11 months. But can I ask on that, and this is a cheeky question, is that also part of your ongoing recovery as such? Is that part of the process as well?
Totally. It's not a cheeky question at all, of course. And recovery, and yeah, it kind of speaks to everything that I do creatively as well. I mean, again, like, I was talking to somebody about this yesterday. Like, I felt at one point with the drinking and to a lesser extent the drug taking, that, you know, like, without being melodramatic, I was like, well, I've run out of road here. Like, I'm done. I can't get through this. Do you know what I mean? Like, I felt I was almost monitoring my own chances of getting out of it. And I was like, well, there's people I feel stronger than me that have fallen by the wayside here. Like, there was friends of mine in Cork that had passed away through addiction and associated mental health problems and stuff. And I don't feel that I got myself through it, but a set of circumstances and relying on other people in recovery and meditation, transcendental meditation, would be a huge part of my both recovery and creativity. And I felt like if I've done that, then other things by comparison are easy. They're easier. So I don't have that thing of, I'm going to collapse here. Like, the circumstances are tougher, so I'm going to collapse. So I got that kind of fighter instinct from it. All right, I suppose. But also I should say that my dad, who sadly is no longer with us, was from Mayfield, the exact same part of Cork that Roy Keane is from. Yeah. So I think a kind of a fighter, like, who do you think you're talking to kind of instinct is kind of built in me.
I know Mayfield, there's four chips on the shoulders.
balanced, like.
Funny you say about this year. Well, myself and Tony had we were going to go touring this year, and we were looking
last
forward
year.
Last year we were looking forward to it, and we were kind of, you know, that's how you get out and meet people. That's how you grow. But we were going to do Cork. Cork was high on our list because, you know, Tony has connections with Cork. So it was high on our list. Are we the type of place the type of scene that would go down well in Cork?
Yes and no. I mean, there's people definitely in Cork who would hate to see you down here. Like, absolutely. They wouldn't want to hear your rubbish at all. That's a big threat, like, you know. And Cork is very... There's gatekeepers. There's socio-political gatekeepers here. There's cultural gatekeepers as well. Definitely. Mm. Cork is it's the best of times and the worst of times generally. But you'd have enough people that would be absolutely delighted to have you and get conversation started. And that again is the pisser about this period, that, like, as I was saying, I would love to sit down with you now and chat officially, but then chat off the record as well, and like, about all sorts of stuff, because then I would go away from talking to you and I'd have ideas. Do you know what I mean? I think that's how this whole thing grows. But that's the beauty of what you're doing, though, that there's a platform with all these different people that I wouldn't have heard their perspective at all before. I would only be imagining it and stuff. But yeah, the long and the short of what I'm saying is there'll be people who won't want you here, but let me know when you're on the way down and I'll go.
Well, that's kind of where I was angling to. Okay, that's where the lead up to is. You sort out the venue. We'll have you on as a guest. We'll throw your name up there. Grab a few people, and we'll just do a good night.
Well, I would wield extraordinary power down here. All right, so
well, yeah. That's so Tony says.
Oh no. We're dying to get to Cork. Let's tell the truth.
Yeah.
It was one of the it was 2 days ago last year. We had a sold out night in Dublin City Centre, about our fourth in a few weeks, Martin, if nice. You remember. Yeah. It was crazy. It was like going, oh, you're not coming back again every 2 weeks. Yeah, we are. And you won't sell it. Oh, yeah, we did. And wow. and we kind of knew. It's like going, oh God, the audience is there. It actually is there.
Yeah.
And of course, COVID did what it did. But to go back to your point, in many ways at the time, And this kind of brings it to a close for me. At the time, I remember thinking, God, we might not come out of this now because this could be, you know, devastating for the Tortoise Shack as a platform. And yet we didn't have any money. And I said to Martin, I'm going to throw this on the credit card. And I plowed a load of stuff into, you know, mics and stuff for everybody who's going to have to record remotely. What's the top thing you have for Zoom? What's remotely.fm? All this sort of stuff. And we said, we'll take a chance and we'll do all that. And now we're bigger than we've ever been.
Yeah.
Now, we can't wait to get back to having, you know, that with people. Wait to get back because they're the best crack. It's the best crack and you just buzz off each other. It is absolutely the best crack.
But you kept on keeping on and now there's a smorgasbord of fantastic interviews and podcasts and stuff for people to listen to. You know what I mean? So fair play to you as well.
And actually more importantly, there's a smorgasbord of people who have joined us on the platform and are doing incredible work.
Oh yeah.
Like incredible work. I mean, if you'd have told me 12 months ago the stuff that the actual Shack is putting out, like we've a new pod coming soon and I can't wait for people to hear it. I can't wait for people to hear it. So yeah, it's great. It's absolutely great. Tyke, I love what you do. Obviously, that's obvious. And I want you to keep doing what you're doing. And I do want to sit down with you and have that chat when we can. We really do appreciate it. I hope listeners, and go back and listen to the podcast with the two Norries, because you know what? I can't do what those lads do. They do it really, really well. And I do think, you know, that's important that we recognize that collaboratively we all get on. Tyke, you do what you do really well. Thanks so much for your time.
Lads, yeah, an absolute pleasure.
I'm delighted to have somebody on who is like me with the beautiful bald head.
Thank you. There should be more of us. There should be. There's only you, me, and Brian O'Donovan, buddy.
And bald heads are beautiful. That's the way I look at it.
Bald is beautiful.
Talk to you soon, folks.
Pleasure, lads. Take care. Mind yourselves.
Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin. Martin and Tony. Speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now.